Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Oh, hi, hello. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am that host of yours, she who loves a good Homeric epic retelling, Liv. Today's conversation episode is not at all Roman, so apologies for breaking my own theme month, but I'd always planned to air this episode in August, and then I added Rome after the fact, so here we are. As a bonus, I decided to keep in the bit where I realize Maya doesn't even go into this rant, but she does threaten to rant about a Roman writer. And I thought, you know what, leave that in, because it makes it Roman. And that is a lead up to say, today I spoke with author Maya Deen, whose novel Wrath Goddess Sing not only introduces a trans Achilles battling the Trojans and all their many allies, including the Amazons or something good in there, but also it looks at the story of the Trojan War in like a Bronze Age historical kind of context and like very ancient Mediterranean beyond Greece context. Basically so many fascinating things. Maya and I talked about everything from her book itself, how she went about shifting and molding the story of the Trojan War into something very much her own, but playing very much on the real history of the region. Oh my God, so much. But we also, like I said, talked about this Bronze Age Mediterranean itself and, oh God, everything. You know, researching the world beyond Greece and the gods and everything in between. I'm not good at describing it, but this conversation was so much fun, so insightful into the wider realm of that time period and the ancient Mediterranean so broadly, how it all fits in with this idea that, like, hey, maybe there was a war that inspired Homer's Iliad, and what would the people have actually looked like, and who would they have actually been if that were the case? Wrath Goddess Sing actually came out last year, but now the paperback is available as well. And so I'm just thrilled to have finally had things aligned that I could have Maya on the show. Gods know I will always want to talk about Homeric Epic, and am always eager for more retellings that like fuck with the myths themselves in interesting ways, because like, isn't that the fun of myth anyway? Conversations, a Bronze Age Iliad, Trans Achilles in Wrath Goddess Sing with Maya Dean.
Yeah, like in terms of your readership, is anyone gonna be like super mad if I spend a long time shitting on like one particular Roman author?
Not even a tiny bit. Who?
Statius.
Oh, of course. Yeah, no, not at all. I like to make a joke out of the fact that Rome is boring. So that's already pre-existing. I also get annoyed that the only thing we have other than the Iliad in terms of like real like Trojan War content is fucking Statius, and so we don't know what the fuck was up. And so yeah, all to say, feel free. I spent like weeks talking about how Virgil's Aeneid is the fucking worst. So
I feel like the Aeneid has some things I like, but I don't like the Aeneid.
Yeah, that's valid. I have been convinced by scholars of the virtues of the Aeneid. And, you know, I've been convinced by some things. And I just think Aeneas himself maybe is where I lose all interest.
Yeah, I went with like so Aeneas is like kind of a, he's kind of a secondary or third string antagonist in Wrath Goddess Sing, where he's like, you know, he shows up, he's dangerous, he shoots arrows at you. Achilles, like, throws a javelin at him that's sure to kill him, except his mom protects. Well, literally, it's just a black swan erupts from a pond, and the javelin hits it instead, because why not?
Yeah.
And he's, like, this cipher of a figure. Mostly, he's an occasion for Achilles to have, like, interactions with Aphrodite, because there's a lot there. Especially there's a lot there if you're like deconstructing the whole Aphrodite Pandemos, Aphrodite Urania thing, to be like, well, clearly.
And I should say too, like, just and then I want you to like actually tell us about your book a little up front. But yeah. Aeneas, I should say, my dislike of Aeneas is Roman Aeneas. I actually think Greek Aeneas is the most fucking fascinating figure in the entire world, because there should be so much more to him, because he's like Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, enormously important, lays the groundwork for Aeneas. Aeneas in the Iliad, like, there's something. There's so much going on there. He's like a complete mirror to Aeneas in terms of like goddess mommies, like stepping in to save the day. Like, there's something there, and then there's like also nothing there. And I'm fascinated by that fact. And I think Rome just like looked at it and they were like, look, like they saw what I saw, but then they're like, we're gonna fucking use this.
Our self-insert opportunity.
Exactly. Actually, gave it to them. They left it there.
But it was in such a long tradition. Like, I remember just my mind being blown when I read some of the details about how, like, Aristotle's childhood guardian was the specific poet that the royal family of Epirus hired to write them into the Iliad.
Wait, what?
There's a reason why the royal family of Epirus suddenly starts having names like Polyxena and Alexander.
Oh my god, that's wonderful.
And it's literally just like 40 years before Alexander the Great's time. Someone was an Iliad nerd and was like, you know what? It'll actually probably really boost our standing when we interact more with like Greece if we really good pedigrees.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I always talk about when I talk about Heracles in the show, is how like Heracles had children with everyone and a bazillion different lovers because everyone wanted a piece. And so, like, I mean, the best thing about Greek mythology is, like, the fact that we have, like, 1,000 years worth of ancient Greece. So, like, the retconning that goes in afterwards to be like, look, we were a part of it. I mean, I talk all the time about how Theseus is, like, retconned into Homeric tradition. Like, obviously, he has a place in the Iliad because it's like, no, he came, you know, before. But, like, the way they retcon him into everything, but then also still manage to make him look like a fucking asshole is, I absolutely love it. They're like, look, he's our hero. He was part of the Homeric tradition. Oh, how? He kidnapped a 9-year-old. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about the fact that Theseus is, like, a jerk. Yeah, like the living he's part. A fascinating character.
Absolutely.
Because he's so heavily rewritten. Actually, like, I think a lot about the rewrites on Agamemnon, because one of the shocking and scandalous things about my book is that it's not Athenian drama Agamemnon. It's basically like, because Athenian drama Agamemnon has to be put in its context as a reaction to Spartan Agamemnon's, like, there was a temple to Zeus Agamemnon in Sparta, right? Like, I think that one of the reasons why they were so comfortable just going with the darkest possible interpretation of Agamemnon in the sort of classical Athenian drama is just because it's a hot take. In fact, I think there's some evidence in the Iliad that Agamemnon is a bit of a hot take because, well, if you look at the holdovers from archaic temple sites and things with names like temple to Zeus Agamemnon, it kind of suggests that maybe Agamemnon's cultural memory was really positive and Homer was like, let's make this more complicated.
I mean, I feel like that's kind of the Homeric tradition, like, in a nutshell.
And yeah, like, so he didn't kill his daughter in the Iliad. He offers her in marriage to Achilles, which would be kind of weird if he'd killed her.
Wait.
Yeah, in the text of the Iliad, he's like, Achilles, if you come back to fight, I will give you your pick of my daughters, but probably you'll want the best one, Iphianassa.
Oh, yeah.
And Jesus. Then he's I like, mean, you know, just, and also all these cities in Sparta, which would be really ghoulish if, you know, the death at Aulis had happened as in the Athenian drama.
Yeah. I mean, even the, like, location, well, and I don't even know enough, but, like, I always just, I think about how, like, Athens kind of pushed themselves into the center of it all too, right? Where, like, they basically don't feature in the Iliad at all. And
yeah.
And, like, when they do, they could have been written in later, like, when they put it, you know, into the record versus the oral tradition, because Athens was, like, not shit back then. And it's just fascinating. Okay, before we keep doing this, though, which is obviously amazing, but clearly could go on forever, tell me about Wrath Goddess Sing.
All right, sounds good. Wrath Goddess Sing is somewhere between retelling historical fantasy and historical fiction of the life of Achilles, using as a touch point, like, the Achilles Among the Maidens, Scyros episode. And it's pretty much a reaction and a forceful reaction to Statius's version, which is like, let's try to explain this away as the most masculine Roman thing possible.
That sounds like the Roman.
Yeah, so, like, in Statius's version, it's like, well, mommy is forcing me to live as a girl, but that's okay because I'm manly, so I'm going to sexually assault a princess, and that's cool. And I'm a trans woman. I obviously find that a kind of objectionable trope.
Valid, yeah. I can't say I read all of Statius because it's Statius, and I haven't had the need to. So I've really only read, like, the bits that, like, kind of fall off, like, where the Iliad doesn't give us anything. So, you know, like, Memnon and the Amazons and everything like that. But I realize, like, yeah, I haven't even, like, I certainly haven't read the Achilles bit. But, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all, because the Romans. Although the Greeks would have been super chill, but they were more chill about that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, actually, there's some interesting... We'll edit this into coherence, I'm sure. But there's like some scholarship basically suggesting that the Achilles on Scyros episode in the Greek tradition before the Romans were like, hold on, you can't have this giant affront to masculinity, was meant to be sort of to imply, like, the depth of Achilles's passion, you know, because what could be more passionate than having an affair with someone while wearing her clothes? Like,
I mean, there's also like that's a real connection to Heracles and Omphale too.
Yeah, exactly.
The first thing it makes me think of. Yeah.
So there's definitely an interpretation of that episode that is not so much trans as just slipping into some of the gaps in classical era Greek understandings of masculinity, mm-hmm. where there's some room for some fluidity, sort of. But at the same time, it's also, I think it also admits a trans reading, and that's the one I wanted to go with. So
yeah,
essentially, Achilles is the only child of the king of Phthia and of a queen named Thetis, who in this version is a human and dead, because we start the book in a very historical fiction place, and then the mythological elements sort of start to spill in and heat things up.
Hmm.
So we're kind of watching a dynamic change of genre happen, which is just,
yeah, I mean,
but incredible, yeah, fun. Yeah, it's interesting. So then it really focuses on not so much Achilles navigating the world, like Achilles's trans perspective kind of becomes fundamental to the story and shifts it without it being the ground that the battle is fought on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so much of it is just sort of following the plot of the epic cycle from the Scyros episode forward to the death of Achilles, and then some ways beyond. But in an increasingly different way that gets stranger as it goes.
I mean, I love a strange retelling. Like, I talk about this a lot, and I know I talked about it to you when we were like setting this up. But as somebody who lives in the mythology, where like that's literally all I do every waking moment, it's hard for me to pick up retellings now, not because I don't think they're good or I don't think they're necessary and valid and all these different things, but like, I can't, like, I need to separate myself and like have other things that I do with my time.
Oh yeah.
But at the same time, like the ones that do intrigue me enough to at least like when I have bandwidth, read other things. Yeah, are these ones that are like playing with the story. So, you know, you're using the mythology, but you're making it your own, and you're making it into these like different, you know, something different versus just like a straight retelling, which I think there's a place for, but it's just harder for me as somebody who like, also because like I know the myth, like the back of my hand for the most part. And so I'm like, you can be the most well-written, beautiful thing in the world, but like, I know what's going to happen at every moment of this book. And thus it's just like not the same, particularly if I'm trying to read it in my free time. It's just like,
yeah
it's hard.
So I think your experience reading Wrath Goddess Sing is more going to be, you may not know exactly what's going to happen, but then once it happens, you'll be like, okay, that makes sense. Because it's engaging. So it's engaging with the myth on a fairly deep level, but it's also engaging with the textual history of the myth, with the gaps in the myth. Agamemnon being not the character, not the received Agamemnon, is kind of one example. Like,
mm-hmm.
Edith Hamilton would probably be upset, but you know, whatever, because she sort of sanded off all the edges where the texts contradict each other, where that 1,000-year retcon tradition gets messy, and I'm really interested in the messiness of that tradition.
Yeah, it's funny because so am I. That's like my favorite thing, is sort of the what we do and don't know and why and theorizing and stuff. But I also, my favorite thing is the gaps. So I've found that like I don't ever want to fill them in. Like, I want them to be gaps, because I don't, like, it's interesting. I don't know. Like, if I had the chance to go back in time, I want them filled in, because I want them filled in by the actual ancient people. But for me, I like the gaps, because to me, it's like, okay, well, I personally can't fill them in, so I'm going to enjoy the gaps. So, like, I get asked by listeners a lot, like, well, you know, if you could live a myth, or if you could like put yourself into a story, all these things. And I'm like, weirdly, like, I don't want to do that. I want to live, like, I just want to, like, I don't know, live in, but not literally, like, the stories completely as we have them, and just like take in all the gaps and the confusion and the wondering and like why these people became this way and who made these changes and why. And yeah, it's just, especially with when it comes to Homeric tradition, because it's like, the questions are enormous.
I mean, they are, especially since like the Iliad is functionally historical fiction. Like, it's set in a world that didn't even have the same mythology. I mean, one of the things that really fascinated me was the extent to which, like, the Zeus as we know him is really a post-Bronze Age collapse conflation that's like, well, let's just pull some elements from the Hittite king of the gods to sort of dress up this hitherto fairly minor god. And then all the Mycenaean sites with, like, Demeter being the...
Yeah. I mean, yeah, women generally, because it's like the importance of women, Bronze Age and pre-Bronze Age, is so enormous.
Oh my God, yes.
Like, sanded down into this sort of like shell of what they were. It's because, I mean, I didn't study a ton of the archaeology and my degree is 10 years old. So, like,
sure.
Generally it's been a while. But all I remember learning about, like, when I did a Bronze Age archaeology course is, like, just the Cycladic, like, goddess figurines everywhere.
Yeah.
And, like, on Crete, oh my too. God. Like literally, that's, like, all that mattered. They're just, like, what the goddesses were fucking enormous, the most important things in the world. But because we don't have, like, the written history from it, it just kind of, like, gets lost in this idea that, like, yes, there were a ton of goddess figurines, but we know so
little.
But we
do have, like, pay records. We have pay records and, like, landholding records from courts. And, like, it sure looks like a society where it hadn't occurred to them to do things like not have equal pay.
What a concept.
I mean, like,
where did that come in and why? Like, how did it just, like, become that?
Well, probably at some point, after the invention of money. No, I mean... It's actually, this is one of the questions I find myself constantly haunted by. Like, when was that invented?
Yeah.
And where?
Yeah. Yeah, like, well,
like, the Hittites had some pay inequality, but.
Well, and even beyond
less than
pay.
You'd expect.
I think more of just, like, how it went from women having basically the same rights as men to the Athens of it all, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, my God.
It's just fascinating. I recently did episodes on Aphrodite, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to do whatever level I can do on her origins, you know, in these Eastern goddesses. And, like, I don't have enough grounding in the Eastern goddesses to have dived too deep, but I could at least look at, like, how they influenced Aphrodite as a great goddess. And it's enormous, and she's always been my favorite because of, I think, all the things that are left over from her Eastern goddessness, like her sexual identity and freedom and the fact that she didn't like her husband and nobody forced her to like her husband. Mm-hmm. They may have forced her to marry him, but, like, they didn't force her to have kids with him or anything, you know, whereas she just had, like, this level of freedom that you can, when you're looking at it in that way, you can see how it's coming from these origins where she came later, whereas, like, Hera had already kind of been sanded down and Aphrodite kind of came in later and held on to things.
There's a new translation of Enheduanna into English out by Sophus Halia that looks pretty good. And
yeah,
I've been thinking a lot about the connection. Like, something that occurred to me reading Enheduanna was like, wow, this I would not be surprised if some of Sappho's Aphrodite poetry has drawn on that, especially given that Sappho had all these connections to Babylonian culture through her family and through her friend circle. Yeah, no, Alcaeus's brother was literally a mercenary captain for the Babylonians.
Wow.
And her family was like a shipping concern. Like, they did a lot of carrying goods from, like,
yeah. That's amazing. I recently
really
learned her. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's fascinating. I recently learned her connection to Aesop through an enslaved woman who was, like, knew him and stuff. And I just, yeah, I mean, the more I know about Sappho, the better I am as a human.
She's such a fascinating figure.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, any connection to Enheduanna. I mean, the fact that Enheduanna, like, existed at all is the coolest thing in the world. And I'm glad that,
like,
there's a new translation.
We have so many copies of her work because she was so durably influential too. Like,
I don't know enough about the East because I've just been living in Greece for too long. Not literally, sadly. But yeah, I mean, just all of that connection. So that, like, reminds me. I heard a lot about you and your writing process through my friends whose show you've been on, Ancient History Fangirl. Mm-hmm. And they were talking a lot about, like, because you pulled a lot of like Hittite stuff too, right? Like you went really far beyond the Greek. So do you want to talk about that a little?
Yeah. So I pull on Hittite mythology. I pull on Egyptian mythology. I mean, really the ancient late Bronze Age Eastern Mediterranean was super interconnected. I think we, living in the shadow of the intellectual world of the Victorians, it's very easy to sort of view these as discrete, separate civilizations in their little boxes that never talked to each other. When in reality, like the Mycenaean Greeks were the people who were carrying goods between the Hittites and the Egyptians. Like Mycenaean elites had like paintings of the Delta, the Nile Delta, in their houses to show how fancy they were. Like, I've been to Egypt. Well, I've been to Egypt. Look how accurate my little monkeys are climbing up these trees, cutting down like bunches of dates for their human masters. Like, there's just the wildest amount of interconnection between these societies. And so one of the things that I was really interested in exploring was both cultural contact between those societies and also just the idea that maybe there's an element that makes it into the later Iliad myth that we could just take literally as being something that would arise in a Hittite context. Like, oh, you know, the half the stories of the Greek gods happen in the former Hittite empire. I mean, like Tantalus of Sipylos, for instance, Sipylos was a Hittite center, and Tantalos sounds an awful lot like a Greek way of pronouncing Hantali, which was a common Hittite name. And a common Hittite royal name, actually.
Interesting. I know nothing about the Hittites also, but I wish
They're so fascinating because there's like elements of like the where it really feels like you're reading the Kronos story with some spicy differences.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
what I did with Achilles was what I was trying to do with the story as a whole, which is to kind of deconstruct the received version of it and then see, like, okay, like if what we've got in the present is the shadow cast by some combination of text and underlying imagined historical and mythological antecedents that gave rise to text, and then we have the reception that we have of the text as sort of a distant shadow of that, what would it look like to try to turn the camera the other way and imagine what kind of combination of mythological events and historical happenings could give rise to, like, the Homeric fandom 500 years later, mm-hmm. which gives a lot of play. There's a lot of room to reinterpret in such a, basically, I wanted to write it in such a way where Homer would be really plausible fan fiction for what had happened.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, that sounds right. I like that. I like the idea that he is, essentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and there are a bunch of things about Homer where I'm just like, also, the received Homer tradition kind of sets me on edge because, like, military historians clearly are determined to, like, I will not rant about chariots, but I've got some really good chariot battles in this book.
What is the connection with military historians now? I'm just interested.
There's this like, all the evidence archaeologically suggests that Mycenaean chariots were used exactly the same way that any other ancient Near Eastern military power at the time used their chariots. Like, they were organized in the same way, their gear was inventoried in the same way and was very similar. They massively invested in chariots. They tracked, like, drivers and chariot fighters completely separately from infantry. And yet, there is still a common perception that Homeric era warfare would be like, then the chariots are essentially just to get you to the front. You hop down, you fight. And it's like, well, no, it was probably a lot messier than that and a lot more familiar to things like if someone fought at the Battle of Kadesh, which would have been 50 years before the conventional dating of the Trojan, 30 to 50 years before the conventional dating of the Trojan War that was popular in the classical period, then you wouldn't imagine they'd be too freaked out by anything they saw happening in Achaean versus Hittite fighting.
Mm-hmm. Much military stuff I've never thought of. I like it.
I mean, you know, you have to, when you've got Achilles as a protagonist, you kind of have to explore violence in all its forms. And I spend a huge amount of time in the story kind of exploring, yeah, what that looks like. What it looks like when you have someone who's, like, you know, sensitive and thoughtful and poetic and bloodthirsty, who kills a bunch of people and then is like, wow, I just killed a bunch of people. I don't know how to feel about that. And then 5 minutes later is like, I will literally eat you in front of your family.
That sounds very right. I like.
No, like, that's the thing that freaked me out the most about Achilles is, like, sort of Aristea, the part where Achilles is, like, threatening, like, Hector's like, you know, whoever wins, like, let's treat each other's bodies well. And Achilles is like, I will eat you.
Literally, no. Yeah. I mean, Achilles is, like, an absolutely fascinating character. Because, like, I mean, I guess just for all the reasons you've just said, but, I mean, a bazillion others. He's just, like, sorry, now obviously I'm talking about, like, broader character of Achilles with my gendering. But, like, yeah, I don't know. It's just, like, he's a fascinating character because he's, like, so important and so big. But then also, like, ultimately, in terms of, like, major mythologies, like, so much of the Trojan War, like, it's just in the Iliad. You know? Yeah. And so, like, I think, and there's so much to work off of because obviously the Iliad is, like, literally all about Achilles' wrath. But at the same time, like, there's so much kind of on the periphery, like the Scyros, and, like, there's just so many things that you can kind of, like, get these sort of different insights into Achilles' character. But like, so much of the fragmentary or, like, really late sourced things, like, you get to ask these questions of, like, when did this come about and who changed it and why?
Oh, like one of the episodes that's completely absent from the text of the Iliad, but that is definitely present in the fragments of the rest of the epic cycle we've got, is Achilles' war with the Amazons. Because Achilles is one of big claim to fame. One of them is destroying a bunch of Amazon cities. And so that's actually so something that I really leaned into.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to hear that about that. But then also, like, there are so many little, like, hey, this guy, like, warred with the Amazons and, like, destroyed them. Like,
yeah.
I say that because, like, I just this week I covered Bellerophon, and there's this, like, afterthought where it's, like, his whole story is, like, all about the lead up to killing the Chimera, and then after he kills the Chimera, it's, like, and then he went and he defeated a ton of Amazons and he came home. And, like, that's it. And that's all we have. Like, that's the details. But I just feel like there's a lot of these moments where it's like, and then they fought the Amazons. And I mean, of course, it's to, like, they, you know, the Amazons were mythologically so important. And so it's this, like, status symbol. But it's so amazing and fascinating that these, like, traditionally, you know, women warriors get to be, like, the thing that everyone went and did to, like, prove their manhood, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, like, the sort of, to split the difference, my take on the Amazons is just like, well, I mean, you know, we've got all of these, like, definitely Adrienne Meyer is definitely in the DNA of this book.
Yeah.
We've got so much archaeological evidence that the classical Greeks were just sort of casually pointing at as, oh, yeah, that's an Amazon tomb. That's an Amazon tomb. Those were Amazons. There was an Amazon city right there. Amazons burned that area there. Like, for me, the simplest explanation is, okay, well, let's just have Amazons there. Like, you don't even have to do that much for them to kind of fit into the archaeological record. You just have to assume that, like, the density of, like, Scythian sites, I don't have a finish to that sentence, but fair. I feel like the thought tracks, you know, like,
yeah, well, and just like the connection to the Amazon and the Scythians, like I feel like that's sort of, I know it's not like 100%, but I feel like that's a pretty well accepted, like, that's what they were, you know, like,
exactly. So I was able to use some of that archaeology to kind of fill in a plausible Bronze Age Amazon society. So they're doing stuff like hotboxing cannabis and they have tattoos.
Oh, I want to hang out with them. Am I?
Yeah. You might be. I mean, and there's also the, I forget which author it is who casually says, of course, everybody knows that the Amazons invented cavalry. And before that, everyone used chariots. But I went with that based on the simple assumption that, like, Bronze Age horses are tiny, right? So
are they?
Yeah, Bronze Age horses were dramatically smaller than medieval horses, which is one of the reasons why chariots were such a practical thing, because you kind of have to start breeding slightly larger horses if you're going to put heavier people on them. But I just have the Amazon society have just been like, well, you know, we'll just put our lightest people on horses, which ends up like a combined arms strategy that also supports this very different gender system.
Yeah, that's great.
And then, of course, that gives me opportunities to have things like Achilles meet a trans man who's like an Amazon who, like, would have been totally accepted in some of the Achaean societies where transmasculinity is present in so many myths that it kind of suggests maybe there was a place for it.
I mean, yeah. Like, I mean, if I have, like, screamed about anything in this podcast enough, it's just the volume of trans stories and the fact that, like, I mean, they're just the trans stories in classical mythology are so much fucking fun because
and
they
90%
not only
of them are transmasc. That's unusual.
You think so? I feel like it's just like that they loved men.
Yeah, no, I think they did love men. And I think, but I think that also, I think that their society was structured in such a way where it was probably substantially like some of the oldest and most thriving trans cultures worldwide are things like Hijras Khwajasiras in the, like, in India and Pakistan. South Asian trans cultures have always been associated with just having particularly strong presence in, like, denser cities and things like that. And I think that that's an interesting possible cross-cultural pattern, at least in various patriarchies in Eurasia over the last couple thousands of years. So like the Bronze Age is still a pretty different world and we have to conjecture a lot. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It seems like there are a lot more myths of, yeah, like, huh, you thought I was a girl, but look, in Greek mythology. And I think that that may reflect it just being a little bit of an easier life path to manage under those circumstances, provided that, you know, you can get a bunch of people being like, yeah, you are a man.
Yeah, that's what I've always seen it as, is just like, and not to mention too, like that for sure, just because men had it easier and, mm-hmm. you know, thus like that's going to be the stories that sort of get told. But like also the fact that what survives tends to have been picked out by dudes.
Oh, yeah, know? Definitely.
So it's like, I'm sure it's like, I have to say this every time I do any kind of like, well, I do like, you know, pride stories every year and stuff. And I always have people being like, I want to hear more like stories of two women in love. And I'm like, so do I. But the ancient Greeks like didn't write them down for us, or the, you know, the people copying them later didn't think we deserved them, or all these different things. But it's like, it's not that the women weren't fucking each other. It's that we don't have record of it because either, you know, it was determined to be like not appropriate for recording. I think it's more likely that the Greeks were so obsessed with penetration that they were like, they're not even having sex. What are you talking
about? That's a boring poem.
Exactly. So I just like the idea that they were like off having so much fucking fun and no one saw it as anything like out of the ordinary, because they were like, well, mm-hmm. no one has the penis, so it's not happening. Okay.
That's not real. It's fine.
No. But yeah, so I think that like kind of results in a lot of the trans mask stories. But like it is like, I just also recently dove deeper into the story of Cineas.
Yeah.
Such a great example of that. And like, And then, of course, you got the like the battle of it all and just like so much happening in that story. And not mm-hmm. least the fact that like chronologically it takes place during not the story, but the story of the story takes place during the Iliad, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's like obviously the source we have for it is Ovid. So it's like super late, but it's still such a great example of like, I mean, just like a trans story, but one specifically relating to battle and the Iliad or the Trojan War itself.
Anyway, oh yeah, there's a Cineas tangent in Wrath, Goddess, Sing.
Mm, amazing.
Because essentially, the way that I constructed in the story, most of the Achaeans after they sort of get the gods basically saying like, nah, like you don't want to fuck with Achilles, don't get in her way. They're like, okay, yeah, well that's fine if the gods say so, that's cool. But then they're all like, but you know, you'd have had an easier time with it if it was the other way around. Like my grandfather, Cineas.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Like that. What a great example of like, sorry, it's just a lot easier to be a trans man. Yeah. Oh my God. Being able to play around with that is so great. So I'm just kind of obsessed with like, intentionally or otherwise, like trying to pepper in a few different like trans characters. You've got these like kind of background stories you can do. Obviously you're focusing on Achilles, but were you kind of making an effort to include more, or was it just happening naturally? Or I don't know, just talk about anything with that.
Yes, it was intentional and also just happening. I was trying to explore not just transness, but also like different ways of relating to gender within a wider range of societies, and like I mean a dynamic range. Like I don't like the idea of like this society is like this, it has the because obviously that's a reification. But like, so for instance, the Amazon trans man I mentioned, his name is Briseis, and so like, which really changes, it does really interesting things because it changes also the dynamic between those two characters completely, and it makes that character a very different character. Like in my reading, he sort of, so like there is some, there were people conflating Trojan Andromache and Amazon Andromache from a really early period. Mm-hmm. So I go with that conflation, and I'm just like, well, you know, the Hittites and the Amazons, used to have a little bit more of a violent relationship, but at this point things are working really well, which is why there's this developing romance, which turns into like, oh, they have a kid, so sweet, between Hector of Volusia and an Amazon who is called by the Greeks Andromache because they're scared of her.
I mean, great. Yeah.
And so like with the Briseis character, it's the same, like he is sort of, when you take that general structure, he's something that arises pretty interestingly out of it, because Lyrnessus can be played as an Amazon city, at which point the way that I handle the capture of him is kind of different, because Achilles is burning her way through the Amazon cities, mostly because the Amazons themselves have been gathering for war, and so she just sails around and back and starts burning their towns. Because she's looking for something, because she's mostly focused on, yeah, she's focused on her thing with the gods. She's like, this is not a war that's going to be winnable in any normal way, because it's almost like the gods are fucking with us on some colossal web, which is just my sort of take on the idea that is it Hesiod's idea that the gods decided to clear the board of demigods, and that's what the Trojan War was for?
I always forget who says that, but yeah, I mean, yeah, this or it's like that, or the earth was too full. Gaia got too full, and so they had to have the war. I love it. I mean,
yeah, it's one of those, like, which is an interesting way of thinking about the Bronze Age collapse too, right? It's very. Like, the Iliad mythology is very much underlyingly about the Bronze Age collapse. So, like, with rendering Briseis as an Amazon, and then rendering Briseis as an Amazon man, a trans man who's an Amazon, one of the things that I was interested in doing was just seeing how different the dynamic between the characters is. So, like, we meet him when he's like, okay, well, stop burning these cities, and instead I'll help you steal the stuff you're here for anyway and surrender to you. Look, I'll be your guide. We'll steal shit. It's fine. I know I'm betraying the Amazons, but they don't really get me anyway.
I mean, the Amazon connection is great because, like, you know, like you've rewritten it for to have this kind of like more distinct connection. But at the same time, it's like the Amazons famously only help the Trojans. So it fits so well to be like, hey, you know, these people are going to come help. So yeah, I mean, writing them into the story like even more is so great. And it kind of like fixes the Iliad, which is so lacking in Amazons, you know, like that's the only reason I read Statius, is because I had to get to the bit where the Amazons show up and that and Memnon. But yeah.
Oh, there's a giant amount of build before Penthesilea shows up pretty late in Wrath Goddess Sing. Just because everyone's constantly talking, I'd be like, oh, you know, like, if she shows up.
I mean, she's
that kind of messed with the timeline to let her show up into just in time for Achilles' Aristea, because why not?
Well, yeah,
it's more dramatic that way.
If you want to have her, like, then she's got to show up before. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. I don't know. I fucking love all of the Amazons and wish we had.
Oh, and that episode was actually something that really gave me a lot of Achilles as a character, because like the whole, like, yes, of course, like there's the kind of classic, you know, oh, I killed her and now I realize she's hot, but I'm more interested in is something like more along the lines of, wow, the people I'm killing are so beautiful, and under any other circumstances, it would be so interesting to know them. And also, I can really efficiently put this spear point through their necks.
So you left out, you know, doing things to dead bodies then?
No. There's definitely, like, Hector gets dragged.
What Achilles does to Penthesilea.
That part... So basically, all that Achilles does to Penthesilea in this version is that hers is one of the bodies sitting out in front of Achilles's tent, and then there's a big rain that kind of washes the blood away from Hector and Penthesilea and all of that. But like, you know, she's one of the dishonored corpses, just not, you know, it depends on like how you want your corpses dishonored. I have limits.
Yeah, no. I just had forgotten about that bit until you said it. And so now I just couldn't. I couldn't.
My imagination of Achilles is such that I'm just like,
for me,
she makes more sense as the kind of batshit, borderline, likable but terrifying trans girls that I know. Where it's just like, wow, you've been through a lot. You're fascinating to know. I would not want to be on the other side of you in a fight. But it does change a lot of the small things, even if the general dimensions of the character are very similar.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it. The thing about Greek mythology, and especially this kind of like Homeric and, you know, archaic and earlier stuff, is like the way it is just so open to like, I mean, melding it to kind of what you want. But also what we were talking mm-hmm. about earlier about, you know, like, the sort of acceptability of trans characters and all this stuff, like from that earlier time, basically, you know, to generalize a lot, but like kind of before Athenian prudishness kind of became mm-hmm. the norm, there's so much freedom in terms of these things. And so you can have this story of Achilles as a trans woman. And I'm just immediately like, yeah, I can see all of this, you know, mm-hmm. existing alongside the existing character of Achilles, because this, like, the fluidity was so much more prominent and there was so much less kind of like judgment around that stuff. Like, yeah. I think even of like the gods, like Dionysus is super gender fluid, like pretty much from the start. And there, and you know, and Aphrodite too. And then we have all these stories of like, you know, trans Aphrodite from the East and all of these like different mm-hmm. ideas that come out. And then we sort of course, everything now is completely determined by not only the like Athenian dominancy over the sources that we got later, but also just like Western
classics
broadly. Yeah.
Like, yeah. The idea that classics is the foundation of the Western tradition. It's a construction that's surprisingly young, but like very influential.
Well, and very white Western Christian. Like it's very determined by these concepts that did not exist in the ancient world. Like every way that we look at these stories now, unless you're like, we're actively working against it, is based in Christian morals and ideals because of everything. And so, it's just fascinating to kind of like break all that down.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity, and it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
So like Helen, my take on Helen is very much, I think, not like there's a standard 21st century take on Helen, which is the standard 19th and 20th century take on Helen, which is that she is the whitest of white women.
Yeah.
But complimentary, not derogatory. She's the whitest of white women, complimentary. And I was like, well, is that really the Helen we have in the text of the Iliad? Is that the Helen we'd like to hang out with? Is that the Helen even that is present in, like, for me, the two things, the two touchstones for Helen are, like, first, Stesichorus, because what could be better than someone adding their take on, Helen was kind of shitty, right? And then Helen decides to manage her reputation by blinding Stesichorus and be like, nah, retcon it so that I was cool.
Ghost Helen?
Yeah, no. The legend with Stesichorus is that the reason he was like, oh, she was just in Egypt the whole time is because he was trying to get his eyesight back.
Yeah. I forgot about that little
and
bit.
I love
like
that
I was gonna ask if what you thought of Ghost Helen, because Ghost Helen's amazing.
I think that that's Eidolon Helen, like Image Helen, yeah. Right?
I just like calling her Ghost Helen.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I kind of have like, so I play with that in some weird ways. Like there's a sequence of the book that takes place in Egypt and Helen's presence is felt. But yeah, like, I don't know. The other touchstone for me with Helen is also just her introduction in the Iliad, which is super weird because the first thing she's doing when we see her is she's making tapestries of the battle over her. And she's like, this has artistic merit. And then she goes up onto the walls to watch the fighting for more tapestry inspiration. And she's like, where are my brothers at? Don't they even care? You'd think they'd be there. I can't see them anywhere. And then the narrator's like, her brothers had died years before. So the narrator's like, sorry, Helen was a bad sister. And then she goes inside and she starts feuding with Aphrodite because she's like, what do you mean? Like, this is really embarrassing for me because the husband you gave me and that other one, they were all set to fight it out, which either way I win. And here you are trying to just like take the pressure off. People aren't going to take me seriously. And then Aphrodite gets mad at her, which is hilarious. But also that take on Helen just is not the received Helen. She's not this blameless.
No, that and like, so yeah, I had actually, like, I really need to reread the Iliad. It's been too long, but also I'm waiting for Emily Wilson's translation. So it's not my fault anymore.
Oh, no, that's legit.
Yeah, like, I have to. I'm like, I have to reread it, but I can't. I'm not going to reread another one when that one's coming out. But so I had forgotten about that moment. But I was speaking with Ruby Blondell because they have a new book coming out called Helen of Troy in Hollywood, which I was going to recommend to you before I even said this. And they're going to be on my show in a couple, I don't even remember when.
Cool.
I think beginning of September. Yes. So we had this conversation about Helen, all these different things. And they brought up that moment when she fights with Aphrodite. And like, she really, I mean, Helen generally, such a fascinating character, like everything you're saying, this like idea that we have of Helen, but then you go to the source text and you're like, where did this idea come from? Because yes, the Helen in the Iliad is like, you know, doing all these things that you mentioned, but the fighting with Aphrodite is so huge to be like, I'm going to fight with a goddess. I'm going to literally tell her she's wrong and then kind of get scolded for it. But then the Helen that like really interests me on top of all of that is the Helen that we get in the Odyssey. Because suddenly
we get
this
who gives
Helen,
everyone drugs.
Like, yes, she's a fucking witch. She comes back from the Trojan War. She's back with the original husband like nothing ever happened. She's fucking drugging people. Like, like basically she's like the prelude to like Cersei. And then the Helen of Troy in Hollywood, the great thing about that is Ruby was like went through and picked out a bunch of these like popular Hollywood based concepts of Helen and then like broke down all the different things about them. But what we were talking about was like, I mean, the whiteness ascribed to her specifically in comparison to like, I mean, you know, what her skin tone would have likely been like based on the fact that she was from Sparta versus this like idea, the, you know, the Diane Kruger Helen of like this sort of blank slate, traditionally just like beautiful, but very sort of, I mean, blank slate, I think is the best way that I want to say it. Like, she's just kind of there. But the Helen of Homer is just so much more than that and so much more interesting. And yet,
because she's a demigod, like in Homer, she's a demigod.
Okay, so I'm fascinated by that. So one, I have this weird aversion to using the word demigod, and that like I just don't use.
Okay, that's fair. She's the child of a deity.
Yes, and so, but that's why I like the fact that you said demigod was interesting, because I think that it gives a different connotation to it. She is the child of a deity, but like, I'm interested in if you see her as a more explicitly child of a deity in the vein of, let's say, like Achilles, you know, Heracles, or child of a deity in the vein of like, I don't know. To me, the difference is like sometimes they're super mortal and they're super like they could be any other human. They just happen to have a divine.
Well, but Helen, in so many of the Helen stories, Helen is like the sister from the immortal egg, right? Like Helen is immortal. Like Helen is the one person in Troy who's probably not in any danger on any level.
See, I wonder though, like, I'm interested in that because the Helen of the Iliad doesn't, and again, it's been too long, so I'm saying this with confidence and I could be totally wrong, but like, to me, she doesn't come across as divine. Like, I know the later stories do, and her parentage, certainly she is divine. But I mean, the Helen on the page, other than fighting with Aphrodite, which I think is definitely in the line of like, this woman's divine. But, you know, at the same time, we have Achilles and Aeneas and why am I not remembering anyway, all the other sons of Zeus that are in the war. But there's one that I just can't think of right now. Thank you. I was like, it's an S and it's not Scamander. That's the river. And I was having trouble. Sarpedon is who I meant. So we have all these ones, but they like die like anybody else. And and it's just fascinating to me.
Well, but also
Helen of it
immortal,
all. I don't have an argument, but
immortal gods die like anyone else too, though. Like we see gods killed multiple times. Like,
well, but yeah, okay. I guess just the use of the word immortal, that's what throws me just from a logic perspective. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's just I don't know. It's fascinating that the way the children of gods work is generally interesting to me, and that there is no kind of like there's no rule, because of course there's no rule in anything in Greek mythology, but.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes it's just more interesting than others.
No, but that's one of the fascinating things about Helen, because as you pointed out, she's a witch. She's got all this knowledge and power. She should be a pretty interesting figure. So there's like a moment where I was just like, well, why wouldn't Achilles just try to sneak into the city and kidnap Helen out of it? And when I had that thought, I was like, well, clearly you can't have a thought like that and not have an attempt.
Yeah.
And that's how I sort of encountered my own vision of Helen, which is she's delicious. She's so scary. I love her.
I mean, yeah, good. Because Helen deserves that. Especially with like what she has become now compared to what she is in the text. Because she just is so much more interesting. And like all these different versions of her, the Stesichorus and the, you know, Euripides is Helen and... I don't know. She contains multitudes and I love her for that.
I think Sappho's Helen is interesting because she's simultaneously portrayed as being actually kind of powerful, but also helpless before the schemes of Aphrodite.
I feel like that, I mean, that tracks, right? Like, especially in the Iliad, because like, mm-hmm. she literally holds all of this power except that she gets scolded by Aphrodite. But like, that's, she's yeah. the only one who can kind of talk back to her. And it, mm-hmm. it really, this came up in this conversation again with Ruby, because I think I mentioned that, like, I don't know, I had kind of made this connection that like, that Helen doesn't, I had forgotten that she stands up to Aphrodite and is kind of torn down. But it's interesting to me that that's the only goddess who could do it. Mm-hmm. Because of course, like, the only goddess who can tear down the most beautiful mortal in the world is the most beautiful goddess in the world, right? Like, mm-hmm. it like takes this like beauty sex goddess to be the one who can finally like actually say something to kind of put Helen in her place, you know, at least in that context.
Yeah. Well, in the sort of syncretist vein of the way I sort of imagined this interconnected like world, I definitely took Aphrodite being the only person who can do that in a very Ishtar direction. Like, she's a really big deal.
That's right. Good. Great.
And with Helen herself, I also kind of conflated her with Eris.
Oh, fuck yes. Okay.
Because the apple thrower might as well be the apple, right? Like,
of course.
Why not?
Also, like, that works. Like, that fucking works in a really satisfying way. Eris is one of my favorite characters of all time. And, like, oh, I love that. Sorry, now I'm just taking it off. I fucking love that.
Yeah, so she's, like, she's this wonderful antagonist because she's so focused on her own agenda, and her own agenda is so specifically for her.
Yeah,
she really doesn't care about everyone else. Like, who wins the war is kind of the least important thing to her. And for that, I was very much taking the sort of artist Helen of the Iliad into consideration. Like, either way, the thing that matters is the quality of the war, because that determines how powerful she is.
Fuck yes. That's where the Eris is coming in. I can feel it. I love it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you've got this very, like, aggressive, naive, kind of emotionally hard on her sleeve at all times, Achilles, who is kind of helpless to have much, like, Helen is the big problem she can't solve by hitting it. And she's just like, well, because Helen can literally just respond with magic, you know?
Yeah, well,
God. Helen has
access
to... I love
the idea that Helen has magic.
Helen has big magic. Like,
yeah.
We know Helen has magic. It's in the Odyssey.
I know. She's amazing. I mean, she's so interesting. Okay, but now you've made me want to know your thoughts on the... I always forget what source it is. But the little afterthought source that's like, oh, and on the Isle of the Blessed, Achilles married Helen.
I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
It's not the angle I took. I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
Aren't Achilles' immortal horses supposed to be on the Island of the Blessed?
I mean,
something.
I do not remember, but that sounds like it's very possible. Yes.
They're major characters in this book, just because I'm very interested in, it's kind of weird the extent to which we're not culturally interested in non-human characters, given that throughout most of human history, there were a lot of non-human animals just sort of woven through our societies.
That's wonderful. The Achilles and Helen bit, I always just think is so funny because it's like, again, it feels like retconning, right? It feels like...
It does.
It almost feels like it's trying to like make up for the Trojan War or something, like this really weird and deeply unnecessary happily ever after.
Yeah. And for like, I don't know, the last people I would give a deeply unnecessary and weird happily ever after to, like.
Yeah. Like, what's the point?
Like, Achilles kills so many people and Achilles kills so many people and is fine with it. And when Achilles doesn't kill a ton of people, well, actually, the period of time when Achilles is not killing people, i.e. the Iliad, most of it, is one of the most interesting things for me, because this book has its own explanation of that, which involves the gods. But that's partially just because one of my favorite scenes in the Iliad is the little barbecue scene where Patroclus is raking out the coals and Achilles is like skewering the meat. And it's just so lovingly described. It's just this weird moment of like, here are our friends. We're happy to see our friends.
It's very domestic.
Yeah, it's a very domestic scene. And it's just such, and it happens right before the night raid.
Mm.
It's just such a weird sequence.
Mm-hmm. God, I've only recorded two conversation episodes since I've been back. But now it's been you and Ruby. And now I'm like, well, shit, I haven't read the Iliad. And I just don't even, well, obviously I've read the Iliad. I haven't read the Iliad in a couple of years. And I just feel so at a loss. And I desperately, now I'm just really.
Well, the Iliad is so good. Like, I know. One of the things, just rereading the Iliad in the process of writing this book, I was just constantly struck by how fresh and weird it is. Like, it's such a strange and incredibly rich narrative that spends, like, I don't know, I've seen too much Twitter discourse over the years. People act as though, for instance, as though Homer himself isn't problematizing war and slavery. Like, the Iliad is so pitilessly like, wow, fucked up. We've got all these hot, rich people killing each other, and also all the poorer people who have to join them.
I mean, Twitter often likes to pretend like the Iliad is both pro-war and pro-Greece, and I find that fascinating.
Like, the Iliad is incredibly anti-war, and that's one of the things that I find so interesting.
Like,
and
the Trojans are like the fucking heroes of that book, but everyone's like, well, because it's a Greek story, the Greeks are the good guys. But like, I mean, I forget, it was fairly recent, I think, when there was a couple, like, and they're, you know, they're all like, you know, they're like, for lack of a better word, probably white nationalist accounts, at least whether they know it or not, ultimately that's what they are.
Types.
They're, you know, their avatars are a marble head of a man. And you're like, great.
Marble
okay.
head, no paint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's all pretend this is what everybody looked like back then. But, you know, they were like, there was a post fairly recently that was like listing out all these reasons why they thought Hector was like the bad guy of the Iliad. And I was like, have you what? Read the Iliad? Because Hector is like number one. Literally, if there is one guy in the Iliad that you can make almost blameless, like, it's fucking Hector.
Oh yeah.
And, like, he's clearly the best guy in the whole work, and it's so funny. And so this, like, this, I mean, I think that the original tweet got like 10 likes, and my reply that just said, have you read the Iliad, got like 400, because I'm like, yeah, no, like, this is fucking nonsense. But there was another one recently too that just like was talking about, I mean, I guess it's just like this general idea that the Iliad is, yeah, like, is a fan of war and saying the Greeks are the best. And it's just so fascinating and so like deeply tied in Western civilizations, but like modern Western civilization, American yeah. Western civilization, right? This idea that like war is good and war in the Middle East might be better, like all these different things, you know. And it's just so wild to try to retcon that into Homer that I'm just like, what are yeah. you fucking talking about?
It's so weird. Like, you, I feel like you can't be paying attention to the Iliad at all and come away with the idea that, like, it is, I mean, I first saw the Iliad read to me when I was like 6 years old, and
adorable.
And my father didn't hold anything back. So I was like, wow, okay, this is a lot. Like, spears are going in someone's nipple and out their liver. Like, that's a lot.
I forgot how many times a spear goes into a nipple. Sorry. As soon as you said it, I was like, there's a number of those references, and it's really specific. Right? I forgot about that. Yeah.
Homer tells you what it feels like to die repeatedly. You just get these, like, that's actually one of the most fascinating things to me, because it's really not, look how glorious it is to leave a bunch of bodies stacked up like kindling. It's really, wow, everything's going dark and you feel cold. That's terrible. Yeah. And that's so neat, because Like, that is genuinely unusual.
Yeah.
And I, like, with the Iliad, I've been spending a lot of time over the last few years, because of the book I'm working on now, deeply immersed in, partially in Egyptian mythology, but also a lot of it in Egyptian state ideology of the New Kingdom period. Because that, like, when I went to Karnak, it was like being struck. It was like, it still works. It still makes you feel very small, and it still makes you think, oh, holy shit, like, these god kings are gonna melt me. And so to see something that is kind of the opposite of the glorification of power, reckoning with the aftermath of that same period, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes sense, because the historical Achaeans definitely lost their war with the Hittites, their wars with the Hittites.
Yeah. I mean, I think too, like, I mean, obviously, like, our, the fact that we think it is so unusual, and the fact that it is so kind of like, I don't know, surprising, I guess, like, that, that there would be this, like, it's explicitly anti-war for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so tied with the now of it all, you know, but also like the last 1,000 years, 2,000 years.
Oh, yeah.
Like, whereas, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously there's so much complexity to, like, quote unquote Homer, and like when these stories actually, you know, were being told, let alone when they were written down for the first time, and all of those different things. But like, it's just such an amazing insight into pre-archaic,
yeah,
like, thought, right? Because, like, even, you know, by the archaic period, we're getting the Persian Wars, and by the classical, we're getting Peloponnesian, and it's, or, like, you know, the in between it all. And so it's like, obviously we're at they're at the point then, you know, when Homer is becoming or remaining as famous, but they're, you know, all into war, and war is like their entire lives. But there is this period that, you know, like, the what will become the most famous poet of the ancient Greek world is writing this epic, their most famous epic ever, about how horrific war is. But so specifically too, like, how horrific a war is when it is being fought over some, like, seemingly benign human thing, you know? Like,
yeah,
this is not a war to save lives. This is not a war to prevent tragedy. This is a war because a man stole a woman. And that's what it's about. Like, it's about how that is stupid and pointless, and it'll just cause endless violence. And I guess even saying that, a man stole a woman, that it's that on two levels, right? Like, it's the Helen and the Briseis of it all. And like, just, all the horror that comes from just stupid decisions being made, and like, war coming from it. And then, now it's seen as this, like, war epic that's, like, all, you know, glamorizing or whatever. Like, I mean, even Troy, like, I don't think Troy makes Troy the bad guys, but, and of course, like, Troy, the movie, has so many fucking problems, but, like,
oh my God,
it is still, I mean, the glorified of the war, it's the most, like, fucking Western civilization thing ever. And I guess we can just be thankful they didn't fully make Troy the bad guy. Like, that was a kind of a step up from what they could have done in the year 2004.
But I really think taking the gods out.
Oh, it's such a bummer.
Yeah, because while I'm doing something different with the gods than Homer is, I think you have to understand what Homer is doing with the gods in order to approach the story.
Well, they're inextricable. Yeah, like, they're tied to the story in a way that you're fundamentally changing everything by taking them out.
Exactly. It's like there was a tangent in my head that suddenly got me to a very different but connected observation, which is also just that the ancient world was not ancient to itself. It was modern to itself, and it had its own ancient world. And that's something that I find incredibly interesting. I think I remember the thing which really struck me and moved me playing Assassin's Creed Odyssey, a very mixed game, was just the Mycenaean ruins everywhere. Because it makes you think about the scale of time. Like,
yeah.
And that's something I'm really fascinated by, because the Trojan War was happening to a society that was already, as far as it was concerned, quite old and living in its modern period.
Yeah. That's the best thing to think about. And I think it's a thing that, like, until you're deep into ancient sources and into ancient history, you don't think about it. And I don't blame anyone for not thinking about it, but it's something that, like, I get faced with all the time from my listeners, because, you know, my show is aimed at people who are just, like, vaguely interested in this stuff. And it is so hard from the way the world has presented us with ancient Greece and with Greek mythology. It's so hard to wrap your head around that, because it seems like this distinct thing, this time period, this, like, the mythology is that this thing that existed in this time and a sort of a like solid state. And so people are always asking me these questions, like, well, you know, you said this, but somebody said this, or there's these three different versions, which one's right? And I'm like, just think about how much time we're talking. 1,000 years, that's like really low. That's like, you know, we're talking like, that's just the written record and not even that entirely. Like, that's ignoring most of the Bronze Age or all of the Bronze Age to say 1,000 years. And even that's like an enormous amount of time. And so, yeah, I mean, just thinking about the time from Homer to Ovid, like, fucking fascinating to think about how they would have seen it. And yeah, like, them existing in their modern world when they have this history and everything that's going to come. And anyway, yeah.
Oh, I'm actually really interested in the 1,000 years after Ovid too. Like, one of the things that really gets self-consciously amputated from the classical tradition in the classics sense, but is really interesting to me, is stories like Troilus and Cressida, which are just these huge medieval elaborations of, in some cases, non-episodes, in some cases, like, episodes that only really start to emerge in late antiquity, and they're weird episodes.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things that are, like, so famous now, but only existed, in, like, Byzantine period. But we think of it as being ancient Greece. We're like, it's fucking Byzantine. One of my favorite things, and this is not actually a good example of that, because I don't think he got very famous, you know, rightly or wrongly so. But I've not read it all, but I love Nonus. And the Dionysiaca.
Oh, yeah, the Dionysiaca, yes.
Yeah.
Like, because the Dionysiaca, it makes you think, wait, is there this, like, ancient Indian origin to Dionysus? And it's like, no, there's this late developing fan fiction about an Indian origin to Dionysus.
Yes, and it's fascinating, and it's great, and it's valid in its own sense, but he's from, like, 4th century CE, and you're like...
Yeah.
Like, he's writing something, and it's interesting, and it is ancient, and it is mythological, but at the same time, it's like, what the fuck was he doing? And, like, I haven't read the India bits. I just know they're there, but I've come at it because he is the best author if you are interested in Samothrace, because he he has this entire, so, like, my obsession characters are Cadmus and Harmonia, they're my people, and they're so lacking in sourcing. But Nonus is like, okay, well, if I'm going to tell you the history of Dionysus, like, I'm going to have to pull you back to before he was born. So let me tell you about how his grandparents got together. And so the, like, that bit is Samothrace, is like this connection. It's sort of almost retconning Cadmus and Harmonia into Samothrace and into the Samothracian mysteries, and adding all these bits, like, before they go to Thebes, before they have the kids that'll then go on and have Dionysus. And it's just sort of fascinating, but, like, there's so many bits and pieces that you can kind of find that, like, some people
have picked
up on.
There's the whole Phoenician, Cadmus trend too, right?
Well, yeah. Like, no, he's always Phoenician. In Nonus, it's that he, like, travels up to Samothrace. Yeah, I don't think they ever make him not Phoenician, because he has to be Phoenician.
I mean, it would make sense. He's a, and Phoenicians were the other international shipping carriers.
Yeah, I mean, even the fact that the Greek mythology gives two Phoenicians control over, like, an enormous amount of their mythos. Like Cadmus brought the alphabet mythologically to Greece, and Europa brought like Europe mythologically to Greece.
It reflects the importance of the Phoenicians. They were hugely important in the world that we end up thinking of as the Greek world, because it was not incredibly interconnected. Actually, are you familiar with Suncunnathon? There's this whole recension to try to fit Canaanite mythology into the larger Greek mythology framework.
Oh, no. I don't know enough about Canaanite mythology. I literally, whatever I learned about Astarte is like what I've got right now. But
So like Suncunnathon was he was a Phoenician writer in the Roman period who was like trying to do like antiquarian studies of Phoenician mythology. And simultaneously trying to be like, so you see, El is Cronus.
I mean, I feel like there's so many of those moments where it's like, you gotta smush them all together. You gotta make, like, I had somebody on to talk about Herodotus and when he went to Egypt, and he was like, I'm gonna make it so that all the Egyptian gods fit the Greek gods, even though it doesn't make any reasonable sense, and there's no need to do this, and it just doesn't fit. And he's like, here is what the Greek corresponding god is to the Egyptian. Nobody asked for this. Well,
but Herodotus also wasn't the person who created Interpretatio Graeca. That was much older. Like, he was just participating in a pattern and just being like, well, I think here's the version that makes sense to me because I've been there. I think this is the Egyptian god who is this god. But then, wait, who's the poet who has like this episode where all of the gods are hiding in Egypt?
Oh.
From monsters.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's this one episode, and I forget which poet, where all the gods are hiding in Egypt because they're terrified of monsters that are just sort of very active in Greece at the moment.
Okay, now I have to look that up. But you did just remind me a great moment in Nonus, which is one of my favorite. I don't think it's retconning so much as like this sort of really additional and hardcore detail into the gods. And it's that, so he gives Cadmus this backstory where he went to, here's my problem, and I'm sorry if I get anything wrong. I have been working for 10 years on fictionalizing this story, and sometimes I forget what I've read in the source and what I've written. I'm going to forget like the location exactly what happens, but basically Nonus rewrites the fall of Typhon, Typhoeus, the monster, into Cadmus. So what he does is he says that Typhon had like laid waste to the Olympians, like fucking basically like not killed them, almost nearly killed all of them, that he had removed Zeus's sinews, is the word that's always translated as, he removed Zeus's sinews from his body and hid them in a cave. And then Cadmus came in, defeats Typhon, and gets Zeus's musculature, basically, and like returns it to his body. And I just think of that as like, I mean, it just reminds me of them hiding from monsters, because it's this episode where like, you've made the gods pretty weak compared to the standard ideology of the gods, where it's like, Zeus could just have his muscles removed and he needed this nice Phoenician hero to come in and give them back. Like, it's just amazing. I don't know. There's just so many little bits and pieces in all the different sources across everything in the, you know, however many hundreds of years you want to lump in together. You can just have anything, really. And like nothing fits and everything's contradictory in just the best possible way.
Oh yeah, that reminds me that I found an opportunity to put a Typhon flashback in the middle of Wrath Gotta Sing, because it's just, there's just this moment where they break into this sacred Amazon tomb, and there's just like this big hot box. So they just start smoking to try to figure out like what's going on, because of course that's the thing you do.
I'm fascinated by hot boxes in your book. Sorry.
That's just because like we have Gethan hot boxes with weed residue on them.
Like marijuana for sure?
Like hemp or that like probably something. Has some
okay.
some form of hemp that had that yeah. probably had some THC content, but probably would be pretty weak weed by modern standards. But like you get enough of it in a brazier,
yeah.
you're still gonna feel something.
That's amazing.
So yeah, we just got this flashback scene where it's a sudden flashback to the Middle Bronze Age, and it's just like, how can I take the Thera eruption and kind of turn it into a Typhon myth?
Yeah.
One of the things I'm really interested in is writing books in which literary realism is just not a thing we care about.
Mm.
The idea that there's like a particular correct way to look at reality. And
yeah.
it just so happens to be like the middle class, elite, Western view from, let's say, 1850 to 2000. Objectively yeah. correct way of looking at reality. That's realism. We know it. Like, no. Like, but that does mean, like, I don't know. Achilles is a fascinating character to me because there will just be random moments where she's just, like, looking at something. And it's she's observing something that I know through the language of physics, but that she is just like, wow, that's a pretty thing. Like all the seaweed underwater seems to be swaying with each wave, almost like there's a wind carrying it. What is the relationship between the wave, the underwater wave, and the wind? What?
Yeah. I love thinking about that in relation to sea monsters because like,
yeah.
nobody was in the depths of the ocean, so all they could see was like what they could see from the mm-hmm. boat or maybe some swimming, and like what fucking questions did they have based on that, or like what assumptions did they make?
Well, I can tell you that there's a subplot where this Egyptian princess who is really intent on learning everything convinces Achilles that what they need to do is they need to find a way to communicate with dolphins so that they can ask them important questions.
Fuck yes.
But it turns out that dolphins, what they actually have to say isn't... Like, dolphins have their own agenda.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so the dolphins
I could tell
basically,
picking dolphins was on purpose.
It's a terrible idea. The dolphins start hitting yeah. on them. The dolphins start trying to convince them to attack other dolphins.
Yeah.
It's just like, what?
I mean, this is an awful fact that I always connect to dolphins, but like they're one of the only mammals that sexually assault each other.
And that does premeditated murder. Like right? dolphins
they're dolphins fucked up. Do, I love...
Dolphins are fucked up in a very
Yeah.
My audiobook narrator just can barely make it through the this line where it's just like the dolphins are just like humans forked for easy access.
Yeah, okay. I can see why she'd have trouble with that.
And dolphins are so fucked up.
Okay. I think that might be a really good note to start wrapping things up because I think that's wonderful.
That's fair. Yeah, it was a really exciting book to write. Like, it's always interesting to take the stuff that is the elements of deep nerding out and turn them into plot elements.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell my listeners where to find you, whatever you want them to know?
Sure. I'm on most social media as at Maya Dean Writer. We'll see how much longer Twitter exists, but I'm also on like Blue Sky, Instagram. We'll see if I'm going to end up on Threads. I don't know. But yeah, like at Maya Dean Writer. Yeah, currently Wrath Goddess Sing is out. I have a story out in Fit for the Gods, the anthology closer. It's my story about the Amazon role in the Titanomachy, which shows up in a couple of myths. And
amazing.
It also kind of features, also shows up in a couple of versions, the different relationships that Dionysus has to the Amazons. Sometimes he's kind of tight with them, sometimes he's their bête noire. So I kind of was like, why not both? And made Marini, the famous Amazon queen Marini, kind of have Dionysus as an ex that she doesn't find particularly impressive.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But yeah, so that's what I've got out now. And obviously the paperback version of Wrath Gotta Sing just came out recently. I highly recommend it. It has a further reading list.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure my listeners will be interested in that because I've forced them to be obsessed with ancient sources, even if it's against their will.
And thank you for having me on your show, Liv. So I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad. Yeah, good. I'm so glad to have you. Thank you. It was clearly a lot of fun. Oh my gosh. Nerds, thank you all for listening as always, and thank you to Maya for talking all things Bronze Age and Wrath Gotta Sing and Achilles and gods, like everything in between. This was seriously such a fun episode, such a fun conversation, because, well, like, I legitimately always have so much fun recording these because I just am an enormous nerd and I always want to know literally everything imaginable, and I'm perpetually fascinated with how authors can, like, take these myths and then, like, make them their own, particularly in cases like this. And, you know, like, anyway, fucking fun. I'm recording this intro very late in the day, but the conversation, thankfully, my brain was fully functioning for. The ancient world is cool and I love it, if I haven't already made that quite clear. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, perhaps now more colloquially known as the assistant producer. Why did I write the word colloquially into my script so that I have to say it every week? The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of ancient Greece and Greek mythology, the ancient Mediterranean. I don't know what I'm reading anymore. By becoming a patron, where I'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv and I love this shit.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.